Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. I'm here with Trev, the co-founder and former CEO of SurePoint Group. Trev, it's great to see you. Thanks for being on the show. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I super appreciate it.
Awesome. So whereabouts are you in the world?
Today I'm in Nisku, Alberta, actually, in our SurePoint office.
Okay, beautiful. Up in Canada. Fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. It's beautiful here today.
Well, let's just dive right in. You know, I'm dying to learn kind of about you and your journey. So can you kind of tell us how you got here? How did you get to found SurePoint and kind of from there, like what's next for you?
Yeah. Well, it's been an interesting journey. I've been with SurePoint for over 23 years. I was a co-founder in the company and we started it back in 2003. And there were me and nine of my buddies came together. A guy named Cordell had actually founded it, brought us all into it around the time that he kicked it off. So we started as a group, but ten owners, 10% each. And we started it in a city called Grand Prairie, which is northern Alberta, and surrounded by farming communities. So I actually grew up on a farm up at a place called Elmworth and got into the trades. My dad was in the trades, and so I ended up, I was going to be a school teacher, to be honest with you, but I didn't want to go to university right after or college. And so I ended up being encouraged to get into a trade, and then I finished the trade. And then in 2003, when we kicked off the company, we came together really as a group of people, encouraged not to, because 10 owners, 10% each, friends, you know, it was a recipe for disaster, but we sort of just said screw it and we went for it. And we ended up building something really, really amazing and kind of unique. And our company from 2003 to 2008, we grew from 15 people to 250 people, and from 4 million in revenue to about 50 million in revenue. And I tell people that, you know, we accidentally grew our company, and it was a bit of a Cinderella story in reverse for a while. We grew to that size, got up to about 50 million, as I was saying, and we ended up selling in 2008. We ended up selling a majority of the company to a private equity group out of the US. So it was actually a turning point for the organization in many ways. Right before the PE group bought us, just slightly after, the price of oil tanked. We had debt we had taken on that hadn't had before. And our company actually continued to grow from 2008 to 2012. We grew from 50 million-ish to over $90 million. And that was our peak at the time. But things were starting to disintegrate. Like the company was really coming apart. Turns out we were losing money. Culturally, we were disintegrating. We were taking on jobs and moving into markets that we didn't have a lot of experience in. And a lot of our people were that had been there from the beginning, that I say bled our colors, were starting to leave. And so it was actually in 2013, I had given notice and I was going to go and do something else. And we had a branch in Australia that I had opened and I was over there. I'd given 3 months notice to our CEO and COO, and they had asked me not to say anything until kind of the final 4 weeks, because I was really a cultural ambassador or a cheerleader in the organization. And so I said, yeah, I'll wait until the final month. And I was in Australia visiting our team over there and said, this is probably my last trip over, at least with SurePoint. And I got a call from one of the board members and they said, you know, Trev, things aren't going really good. And we think it's time to make a change. And long story short, they offered me the CEO role. And I was like, no, I can't, you know, no, it, I don't want to, and I can't, I'm planning on doing something else. I said, I've given notice, like I'm done in 5 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks. And so I flew home and I come home and I tell my wife, well, by the way, they offered me the CEO role. And she said, oh my God, don't take it. Like, I know what this means. I'll never see you again. And I don't want you to take it. And I said, no, it's fine. I already turned it down. And a couple of days later, they called me and talked to me again. And I went home that night and said, you know, they've talked to me again and offered it to me again and asked me to reconsider, but don't worry. I've already let them know that I'm not going to take it. And that night she said something to me. She said, I don't want you to take it, but she said, how are you going to feel if you don't? And I said, well, that's the problem, Renee, is I recognize that our life changed in 2008 because a whole bunch of people sacrificed for us. And when we sold the company, I was super grateful, but I never felt really good about it, to be honest with you. I said, the next day, 10 of our lives changed. And I, as I said, grew up on a farm. My wife and I never had a lot of money. And all of a sudden, you know, we were financially very comfortable. But I said 240 other people's lives didn't change at all. The next day, the most or the best they could hope for is that the new owners treat them at least as good as we did. And here we are now in a situation where the company is not doing very well. Culturally, we're disintegrating. And I said a lot of people quit really good jobs to come to SharePoint. And many of them did because I told them we were different. And we were different and we were better. And arguably, you know, we're worse now. And I said to her, I said, the only reason why I'm not going to take it or I've turned it down really is because I don't know how to be a CEO of a company this big. And because I can afford to sit on the couch for a while. But I said, I'm always going to wonder if I could have made a difference. And I said, and so in the end, I agreed to take the role. And so I came into SharePoint as an instrument mechanic. My background is such, I'm a tradesperson with, a, you know, without any real business education at all. And so I take the role. And things are going pretty good for about 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. I go out and I meet with the bank out in Toronto and have a conversation with them. You know, things are going good, but they said they have our back and, you know, they're going to support us. And about 10 or 12 weeks after I took the position, I was in a meeting with a client and I stepped out to grab a coffee and I opened up my email and we got what was called a letter of forbearance. And I didn't know what that was other than it was bad. And so the bank had actually swept our account that the night before, froze our line of credit. And so we had no money and put us into forbearance, which they said, basically you have, you know, 4.5 months till the term debt is up. And so they wanted us to inject, I think it's about $3 million of capital, find a new bank, or they were going to call our term debt, which would have forced us into foreclosure. And so I'm freaking out. I'm like, you know, now I wasn't even going to take the damn role and now I take it. And so my ego was flaring, to be honest with you, like really, really bad. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to be the guy known as the CEO who bankrupt SharePoint and going through all this stuff. And about a week after we got the letter of forbearance, I woke up in the middle of the night, I think it was a Tuesday, and instead of, and it was common for me to wake up at that time stressed, and instead of me being like super stressed, like normal, I was actually inspired. I was like, wait a minute. The only thing I knew that had made us very successful in the beginning was that we had an amazing culture. And we didn't talk about culture. I didn't know about culture. But I knew when I took the CEO role that I was looking for a way to rally the team, to get us to come together around something. And it hit me like we rally around crisis better than any company in the world. And I was thinking more of it from the perspective, if somebody's kid was sick in the hospital and had to be in Edmonton and their family needed to be there with them for a month, we would raise $8,000 from the employees in a day. Like someone's grandma's house would burn down and we would come together. And I was like, we rallying around crisis better than any company in the world. And there's no bigger crisis than SharePoint might not be around in 4.5 months. And I was like, I've been thinking of this all wrong. This is actually what I've been praying for. This is a gift. And I coined it the gift of forbearance. And I got on the road that morning and I went to every branch and every shop. And I spent the next few days traveling around. I went and saw our technicians in the field. I went to, you know, people's houses. I went and had coffee with them in their towns and told them to bring their spouses. And I basically told everybody the same thing. I said, hey, you know, I'm Trev, I'm the new CEO and most of you know me and I am way over my head and I'm going to need so much help. And then I said, you know, I'm sorry we screwed this thing up. We didn't mean to. Like we had something really, really amazing and now it's not very good. And I understand that. And I'm sorry, you know, and I'm going to do everything I can to try and make that better. And I said, and there's one more thing I have to tell you. Last week we got a letter of forbearance and I don't know how to explain it very well other than it's bad. And things are going to get a lot worse before they get better. And if we don't do a lot of things right in the next 4.5 months, there's not going to be a SharePoint. And I want you all to know so that you can go and you can make the best decision for you and your family. But I hope you stay. I said, I've decided to stay and I hope you stay. And if you stay, I have no idea how we'll get through it. I just know for sure that we will. Together, we'll find a way. And I promise you on the other side, we'll build a better culture than we've ever had. And I'm committed to that. And almost everybody stayed. And then I went to our vendors and I was told, don't tell your vendors you're in forbearance. I'm like, well, you know, that didn't make sense to me. So called our vendors in and said, we're not paying you because we don't have any money. So what happened and the bank did this and we need your help. And most of them helped us. And then I went to some of our clients and was like, can you quick pay? Like told them the story and that we need some support and they helped. And we decided in 2013, 2014 that I wanted to prove that caring was a competitive advantage in not only in life, but in business and certainly in our industry. And we rebuilt SharePoint on a foundational core value of caring. And we changed the entire vision and mission from, you know, we want to be the best E&I company, electrical instrumentation, or we want to, you know, be our client's favorite company. We exist to empower people and improve lives. And then we went all in on that. Yeah, most people stayed, and it was pretty remarkable.
Wow, that, I mean, that is truly like the comeback story of the year, right? I mean, having a company on the brink like that, especially one that you built, this is your baby. I can only imagine what that must have been like. And I'm curious how that has affected you for the last 10 years, right? How that vision changed the company from being, you know, almost bankrupt in forbearance to where it is now. And now I know you're the former CEO and you're heading on to new adventures and new things in your life. So I'm curious what you take from that and where that's leading you.
Yeah. And so it's interesting. So, you know, we started to get healthy, and then 2015 was really hard in the industry and kind of take a dip, but we get through that. And then in 2018, the private equity group reached out to me and said that they were going to sell SharePoint. They were going to list it. It was the last company in the fund. And I was actually relieved because, again, my plan was to leave SharePoint at the time they exited. And I had a really nice exit clause in my contract. And so they tell me about it and they're going to list it. And I called them the next day after that conversation and said, don't list it yet. I said, I want to go to the team and see if they want to buy it back. And so I ended up going to 15 people in the company. I was the only co-founder left in the business at the time. And so I go to 15 of our folks and say, hey, you know, SharePoint's for sale. Would you like to buy it back? And they all said yes. And I said, I'll do it one more time with you all. Like, I'll come into this one more time and do this, as long as you're all open to us becoming an employee-owned organization. And everybody agreed to that. And so in December of 2018, we buy the company back. And so, you know, we take some debt on, we get some help from a local small private equity group and a private individual investor. And we buy it back. And 2019 is pretty good. 2020, April of 2020 was supposed to be the best month that we'd ever had in the history of SharePoint. And March of 2020, the wheels come off the bus. And so here we are, you know, now I've got 15 people that I love in this organization, most of them young, you know, in their 30s or early 40s, who remortgaged their houses to buy back in to SharePoint to help us, you know, to help us buy this thing back and to be an owner. And now, like, I think, oh my God, what did we do? I just made a big mistake here. Like, we're going to bankrupt all our people. And so kind of same thing. We're in lockdown. I'm locked up for a while. And I was on a lot of different, I was part of a lot of virtual peer groups through different industries even. And everybody was kind of saying the same thing. Like, how do you get through the pandemic? And it was conserve capital, reduce costs, which in our case meant lay people off. So I'm in isolation and we're kind of doing all this stuff. And we spend 2 weeks and we finalize a list of people that we're going to lay off. And one Friday morning, we finalize it. One of our young VPs and our CFO go through it. And we decided on the Monday we were going to start releasing people. And Friday night, I called our CFO and our VP and said, don't let anyone go. I said, don't let anyone go yet. And they were like, huh? I said, we don't have enough information to make a good decision here yet. I said, we don't know if this thing's going to last 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years. We don't know if half the people are going to die or no one's going to die or everyone's going to die. I said, we don't know how bad this is going to affect our business if we're going to, you know, lose all of our business or 60%. We assumed we'd lose 40% maybe. We ended up dropping by about 60. I said, but the only thing we know with certainty is that everyone is being told to stay home. And they can't go see their parents and they can't go on dates with their spouses and they can't get other jobs and the kids can't swipe on Tinder. Like, nothing is normal right now. And I said, and the other thing we know is everybody is having some sort of fear, either fear of economic insecurity or fear that their parents are going to die or fear that this is going to affect their kids. Like, that's the thing that we know for sure. And we say we care. We are never going to get a better opportunity to prove it than right now, ever. And I said, and we have an advantage. We have a playbook to go back to. In 2013, when we were screwed, we went to the team, told them the truth and asked them for help. And they helped us. They helped us get through this. So I said, Monday, we're going to have a town hall and we're going to have a town hall every single week. And we're just going to tell everyone the truth. So we have this town hall and we say, hey, we have a list of people that we were going to let go and we've decided not to. And we're going to run this thing as far as we can, right to the edge of the cliff, without, hopefully without going over. And if we see that we're not going to make it, our goal is to try and get as many people through this as possible all the way to the end. And if we know for sure that we're going to go off, you know, go off the cliff, we're going to let everyone know a few weeks ahead of time that we're going to have to start making some cuts. And so that's the strategy that we ended up taking. And it wasn't long after that we realized, hey, so now we're not letting anyone go and it feels good. But a lot of our people, they only get paid when they go to work at their hourly. And so they get paid if they go in the field. And we were seeing a major slowdown in work. And so a lot of our people weren't making any money. And so some folks were asking for layoffs so that they could get CERB and they could at least have some income coming in. And we recognized there, we found out that we qualified for the Canadian Wage Subsidy Program. And I was in my home office and I was literally kind of writing on a napkin. And I'd come up with this concept of what if we guaranteed everybody a paycheck? You know, we used the subsidy and then we guaranteed all of our first years $2,500 and all of our journeymen $5,000, something that we've never done in the history of our company. And I don't know if it's been done in the history of our industry, certainly from a service company perspective. And mm-hmm. So I call our CFO and I say, hey, I have this plan and what do you think? And he goes, well, that's awesome, Trevor, but we can't afford it. And I said, but I think we can. And what if we can? All I need you to do is support it. If we can find a way, will you support it? Because I'm going to go to the board with this and they're not going to support it if you don't support it. So he said he would. So I go to the board. That exactly happens. I tell them, they say, you're a nice guy, Trev. This is awesome, but you can't afford it. And I said, will you support it if we find a way? And they said, yes. So I got about 25 people on a call and I said, hey, you know, how do you feel about this? Like everybody was pretty pumped that we were keeping all our folks. And I said, what if we guarantee everybody a paycheck? And I tell them the model and everyone's like, yeah, that's awesome. And I said, well, there's one problem. We can't afford it. I said, the way that we're structured right now, we just can't afford it. And what I'm about to ask might be the most meaningful thing that you ever do in your career. And I said, and everyone's going to have to sacrifice, and it's not going to be fair at all. Some are going to have to sacrifice more than others for us to pull this off. And if anybody in this meeting says they can't do it for any reason, then we'll leave here. We'll never talk about it again. It's a safe space and we'll find a different way. But I said, what I'm about to propose is this. I'm willing to take a 50% pay cut for the duration of the wage subsidy program if I need to. And so everybody in the company knew how much I made. And I said, so if you're a dollar over that or you're $30,000 over that, you have to come down to that number. And so the significance of this was our managers and general managers gave up between 10 and 15% of their pay. Our two young VPs and our CFO, all of them at the time were in their 30s, late 30s, I think. And all these people have SUVs and kids and mortgages and, you know, they have too much stuff probably, but they have it. And they were giving up 30 to 35% of their pay. And it took us less than 30 minutes for everybody to agree to do this. And then the rest of the company gave up 10%. And for 7.5 months, everybody took that reduced pay. And then Cam, our CFO, and I did for 9 months. And that's how we got through the pandemic. And we kept our folks and everybody found a way to buy some groceries.
This is the true story of leadership, right? There's a difference between a boss and a leader. And if you're leading by example and you're taking the lead saying, I'm doing this first, will you follow me? You know, that's different than a boss saying, do this, do this, do this. I just love that story, Trev. It's incredible. And it shows to me kind of something we were talking about off air about the vulnerability that you can show while still being strong, right? You're projecting strength in numbers to the people you're asking to help by being vulnerable. I wonder if you could kind of tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So I say it often, and I've proven this at least to myself, that vulnerability is a strength in leadership. And I always tell people, you know, when we were going through the pandemic and we were having our meetings, we started to, like I would say, we weren't doing core value stories to kick off our meetings anymore. I said, we're going to do a feeling check-in. And I said, you know, I'm going to hear what you think and we'll figure some stuff out, but I want to know how you feel. And so I would often lead with, you know, I'm feeling some anxiety. Like there's a lot of uncertainty here right now and I don't know how we're going to get through it, but I know that we will. Like we always figure out a way and we will always figure out a way. And I always tell people that vulnerability isn't a weakness. And I couldn't go, and it's not fair to be emotional and emotionally vomit on your team. I couldn't go into a room and say, you know what, I'm feeling tons of anxiety and I don't know how we're going to get through it and then end the call. Like that's not leadership. But what we found is that when I started this whole thing and started talking about caring and started talking about feelings, a lot of people would leave the meetings. They didn't want to do it. And I'd be like, well, we're going to do it every time. So, you know, keep coming back. And we started to see that many of our type A, you know, male strong leaders were starting to use language like, hey, I'm super proud of you, and send emails out in the company. And it became our thing. Like, caring really is a competitive advantage. And I believe that, you know, to care about somebody, vulnerability is just an important part of that. And the other thing was, caring can be taken as really soft as well. And I said, I've learned this actually, because we didn't always get it right. You know, sometimes, you know, we got nice confused with caring, but caring is the foundation for accountability. When you care about somebody, you're going to do what you say you'll do. And so for me, you know, this has been a lesson in life as much as anything for myself personally and our team. And coming out the other side of the pandemic, this is where the real magic happened. And it was, our company had shrunk down to about $30 million coming out of the pandemic. And the decision we made put us in financial distress again. Like, we were out of cash, out of money. Like, it was really, 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 really tough. But this story started to get out. Plus, we had a plan to roll out the employee share ownership program. And we'd held off on it because we didn't want to take other people's money if we weren't going to make it through it. And so we're coming out of this, and this story started to get out, and it was pretty unique, it turns out, you know, what we had all done together and sacrificed for a greater good. And the story starts to get out, and we started to attract a lot of people, and we bought a company and merged it in, and all of the people stayed. And it took us to about $48 million amalgamated at the end of that year. And the next year, we ended up hiring 125 people in 9 months. We grew our company by over 100%. I think it was closer to 125%. And we ended up going organically from $48 million to $96 million or $98 million. And that put us into a major tailspin. We were onboarding people that had to onboard people, ran out of working capital again. Like, it created all these things. But it attracted some of the very, very, very best humans in our industry, like the talent that came into our organization because of this. And it was something that I believed it would be a competitive advantage, using our culture and We Care, mm-hmm. and doing the right thing, which I believed what we were doing was the right thing. But I had no idea the compounding effect it would have. And so I led SharePoint until the September 2020, our fiscal year end, and I resigned as the CEO then and took a president's position. And at the time, we had just broken over $125 million and now brought in like some awesome leadership that really will take the company further. It's a lot bigger than that now. And at the end of last year, I actually resigned as the president of SharePoint, and I'm working for SharePoint in more of a business development role, really focusing on some of our international opportunities. And I'm working a few days a week now with SharePoint and starting to get into coaching and speaking and doing some other stuff.
Jeez, truly inspiring. So leaving SharePoint now, doing some coaching, what's kind of next for you? How are you taking this vision of leadership and being vulnerable as a leader and helping the world? What's your next steps?
So as I had shared with you earlier, I have a personal mission now to positively impact 100 million lives by December 31st, 2030. And I actually don't know how I'm going to measure it, and I don't know exactly how I'm going to do it. You know, I hope to share this story and, you know, the SharePoint journey and my journey with others, and hope that that's inspiring to other people, and that it helps other people know that, you know, like, life is hard, and the journey as a leader is really, really, really difficult sometimes, but you don't actually do it alone. I believe that, you know, through some podcasts and through some speaking, I've started to do some speaking on this and on mental health as well, because I had my own journey on that throughout the years too, and doing a book and doing some coaching and some consulting. And I believe that if I can help leaders to become, you know, more emotionally in tune, and healthy leaders build healthy teams and other healthy leaders, which builds healthy companies, which really helps build healthy families. Because I haven't met a person yet who doesn't, if they're stressed at work, that just goes home and it just evaporates the minute they walk through the door. And so I believe that healthy companies and healthy leaders will help build healthy families, and help healthy families help build healthy communities. And so that's sort of the direction that I'm going right now. I'm a big advocate for men's mental health. And so as part of the journey, I get asked a lot about, you know, where did I find the courage, or what made me, you know, decide to go and tell everybody that we were screwed in 2013 and that I was over my head and needed a lot of help. And the truth is, 2 years earlier, at a time in my life where I had absolutely everything that I believed everybody wanted and needed to ever be happy in their life, I was in the darkest place I'd ever been. I ended up, my wife and I had separated, and this was after we sold SharePoint. So after we sold SharePoint in 2008, I was 36 years old, I think. And from that moment until 39 years old, my life spiraled. I was making bad choices. The reality is I hadn't really felt good most of my life. I'd always felt inferior and insecure, and I was always really afraid of everything. And at 39 years old, here I am. My wife and I are separated. I'm living downtown Edmonton in a really fancy condo. And I'm telling people the truth. They, you know, how are things? Oh, they're good. You know, things are good. My wife asked me to leave. My son's turned 18. He's really not talking to me. I might get kicked out of the company I co-founded because things weren't going really well for me. But, you know, that's all good. And everything happens for a reason. But the truth is, when I'd go back to that condo at night, I would lock every door in that building. And I would often take my food into the bedroom, lock the door, and eat in the dark. And I would lay in the fetal position all night. And I'd wake up the next day and I'd go and you know, put on the facade and just take all the courage I could to just go out and face the day again and tell everyone that everything was good. And one day I woke up on a Monday morning on a bathroom floor of that condo and with an almost overwhelming desire to end my life. And I was laying on the bathroom floor, and this was like 14 years ago, and I can tell you every detail. I lived in that place for under 3 months. I can tell you every single detail of that bathroom, the tile, the color, the specs in it, the sink, everything. I will never, ever forget it. And I got up off the bathroom floor and I went to the mirror and was starting to wash my face. I was starting to cry. And I had made a commitment to myself when I was in my early 20s. I was never going to cry and not like have a breakdown again because a woman broke my heart and I ended up crying and crying and crying. And here I was, I'm fighting back tears. I'm thinking of ending my life. And for some reason, my eyes caught my eyes maybe for the first time ever in my life. And a thought occurred to me, what would I tell a friend if they said, you know, they had a beautiful wife and a son, and they're close to their parents, and they're close to their sisters, and they have a great friend network, and they're part of this amazing company, and now they have money, and they have a fan, and the sports car in the garage, and all this stuff, but they feel the way I was feeling. And I thought, oh my God, I would tell them I get it. I would tell them that I totally understand, and both are real. Please, please go get help. Please, please don't give up. Please go get help. And the thought occurred to me, get help. So I grabbed my phone and I Googled and up came psychiatrist, psychologist. And I was like, this is where my mental state was. I was like, here I am choking back tears, trying to think of a way to end my life. And I don't want to reach out to a psychiatrist because I don't want my friends and family to think I'm crazy. But thankfully I went down the list and there was this random life coach. And I'm like, I can sell this. I can sell a life coach. So I reached out to this life coach. I sent her an email and basically just said, hey, you know, I'm looking to see if you have any openings. I'm struggling with a few things. Didn't get into anything. Hit send. Under 30 minutes later, she gets back to me and says, oh, I actually just had a cancellation. I have an opening tomorrow. And so I actually fought through the night. I get cleaned up. I go and see her and I sit down with her and she asks me how I'm doing. I'm like, I'm fine. You know, I'm good. And she says, what's going on? Why are you here? Well, my wife and I are separated. My son's not talking to me. I might get kicked out of the company. But other than that, I'm good. Like, I'm fine. And she said, you're not fine and you're not good. And back and forth a little bit. And then she said something to me that, you know, was very impactful. And a moment later changed my life. She said, you're not okay. And I'm very worried about you. Please do not leave this office. She said, and I can't help you. Please do not leave this office. Promise me you won't leave this office. I need to go get somebody right now. And so I said, I'll stay. She walked down the hall and she came back a minute later with this big guy named Dr. Gons. And that man helped change my life. So, and I wasn't fooling the universe because she was a psychiatrist. So I took that. In 2013, when I became the CEO, and you know, we're on the brink of death, basically, like the end is near. And I was like, for 39 years of my life, I had tried to figure out everything on my own. And that led me to a bathroom floor where I was gonna end my life. And when I reached out for help and I got to meet this guy, Dr. Gons, I wasn't judged or ridiculed. There was help, there was understanding, there was empathy, there was connection. And I was like, so if I try and figure this out on my own in 2013, we're dead. Like that's inevitable. We're inevitably going to end up in the same spot. And so I just took the two and was like, yeah, you know, when I reached out for help and was vulnerable in my personal life, I got help and it changed my life. And so that's where I found the courage. And I always tell people too, that, you know, I had an advantage. I was never smart enough to go to Harvard and get an MBA. And so I didn't know the book of business. I just had to go with my kind of with my heart and my intuition.
Wow. You know, there's a saying, right? It takes a village. And in Western societies, we've gotten away from that. You know, it's about the individual and get away from your parents and, you know, all these kinds of things. But it still holds true. People need people. We are social creatures. We need empathy. We need sympathy. We need to be together. We need to be able to share with somebody what's going on and realize that we are not alone in whatever struggle we're having.
100%. People need people. And that's exactly what I said during the pandemic. I said, this is a time where people need people. We've had to restructure our company before. You know, we made a lot of mistakes. I like to come on to podcasts like this and talk about all the successes. I tell people that I stepped on almost every rake in the field trying to figure shit out. Like, you know, it's just the reality. I mean, you know, we did some things wrong, but we did a lot of things right. And one of the things that I feel that we did really, really right was that when we would make a mistake we would acknowledge it. We'd do our best to acknowledge it and to right the wrong. And so vulnerability proved to be an extreme strength in my personal life, you know, because I had to be vulnerable. I had to go and tell somebody the truth. And so I was going to Dr. Gons. He pulled me out of that room where I was in with Anne, and he talked to me for a few minutes that day and asked me how I was doing. And I said, you know, I'm good. Anne's got me a bit freaked out, but I'm fine. And I left there feeling a little bit different, and I probably talked to him for 10 minutes. She pulled him out of a session to come in and talk to me. So she saw something, you know, that I thought I was hiding. And I ended up going to him like a couple times a week for multiple months. And one time I went and I sat down in his office, and he didn't say anything other than this. I sat down and he said, hi, Trev, how are you feeling? And I blurted this out. I said, how am I feeling? I said, I felt insecure and less than inferior my entire life. I said, I'm afraid of everything. I'm afraid of success and afraid of failure. I said, I've spent most of my life feeling sad. And when I'm not sad, I'm numb. And I said, I am lonely all the time. I'm lonely when I'm all alone. I'm lonelier when I'm with my friends, and I'm loneliest when I'm with my family. And I don't know what the hell is wrong with me. And I blurted that out, and I was like, oh my God. Like, you know, when you say that thing to your wife that you wished you hadn't saw, that's exactly how I was feeling. And I wanted to suck it all back in. My mind went to, this guy that I look up to and respect is going to tell me that, you know, I need to be stronger. I need to be more positive. I need to be more grateful. Look at all the stuff I have in my life. And instead, he looked me in the eye and he said, oh man, I get it. I get it. And he said, thank you so much for being honest with me. And thank you for being vulnerable. I know that's hard. And he later told me if I would have told him anything different, he wouldn't have believed it. And so, you know, I left that. That's another moment in my life almost 14 years ago, as I said, or maybe a bit more than, where I can tell you that one part of the conversation, I can tell you how I was sitting, the office, how he was sitting, how he was looking at me, you know, everything about that moment I can vividly remember, because that changed my life. I left that. I don't remember a whole bunch of the rest of the conversation, but I left there feeling different than I'd felt in my entire life. I'd finally told somebody the truth about how I was feeling, and I didn't get judged and ridiculed. And not only did I get empathy you know, I got guidance and I got help, and he gave me suggestions, and he helped put me on a path. And I tell people the darkest day was the day on the bathroom. Darkest day of my life was the day on the bathroom floor. And the worst day of my life became the best day of my life. Like, that was the catalyst for change that got me, you know, to where I am today with the perspective I have and the life I have and the mindset I have. And I did a lot of work. And when we went into the pandemic, I said, we are not going to squander this opportunity to build a better culture than we've ever had. We are not going to squander this opportunity to build a better business. You know, this could be the worst day of our life that could be the best, become the best day of our life as an organization. And so I just took all of these parallels into business.
Wow. Well, I know that people are going to want to get in touch with you. I know they're going to want to hear more of your story and find ways to connect with you. What's the best way for people to reach out to you?
So right now, as I'm sort of transitioning into a new corp called Unique Speak, I'm just using a Gmail address. It's trevor.meir2016@gmail.com. But another way you can get me on any of the social media networks. I'm very, very active on Facebook and Instagram, and very active on LinkedIn. And if anybody reaches out to me, especially I check LinkedIn often, multiple times a day, if somebody sends me a message, I always get back to every single person on there. And I'm always happy to chat about any of this stuff, leadership or, you know, just life in general, because, you know, it can be hard and it is hard, but it also can be beautiful. And those darkest days can become catalysts for, you know, a future that you couldn't even ever imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. Trev, thank you so much. It's an absolute pleasure getting to know you. Please do reach out to Trev. He's just an incredible human being. I can't wait to see what you're doing next, Trev. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you having me on here today.